I'm going to put on the chart a hippopotamus and a crocodile. So, but I'm not going to stress that. That's just what I put on the chart. That's what I believe they are. But that's as far as I'll take that. So he's going to talk about these beasts now, these creatures. All right? And these apparently were creatures that were common during the days of Job. He uses them for Job to consider. So, chapter 40 now, 15 to 24. And let's just look at some of the attributes that are mentioned here. The end of verse 15, he eats grass like an ox, so he grazes like that kind of a beast, like that kind of an animal. His strength is in his loins, power in the muscles of his belly. Sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze. Verse 18. His limbs are like the bars of iron. So far, what's the description you get in your mind when you hear terms like that? Well, he's just a brute strength. Just raw, sheer raw power. Natural power. It's not superpower like Superman. But this is how God made this creature. How was he fed based on verse 20? How does such a creature like this eat? Buford, what does it say? Mountains bring him food, so he lives off the land. Verse 21, how does he relax? He lies under the lotus plant. Covers it with he's covered in shade. What I also want to stress was also the end of verse 20. It's a description that's not about him, but it's about his surroundings. How does verse 20 describe the other beasts? Now, I want you to think about that just for a minute. We're talking about an animal, a beast or some creature, that is awesome in size. It is impressive in its characteristics. Typically, if you think about something like that, some big, huge, mammoth-sized thing, how do you think the other animals would react to that, usually, typically? Well, they'd be afraid of it, wouldn't they? Wouldn't want to be anywhere near it. Yet, what does the Bible say? While he's there eating, what do? Not bothering them. So, well, yes, he's a grazer. That's correct. That's true. But still, my point is, other animals know about this beast. And that's the wisdom of God. So here is an animal that is this size, this huge, this impressive, overtowering, yet he's docile enough that the other animals aren't afraid just at his sight and run away for cover. Yes, Buford. Absolutely. And I think that's the point he wants Job to consider when thinking about just this one creature. Now, Job, tell me, you explain to me how this one situation, how that works itself out. Explain to me how that works. Couldn't do it. Could not do it. They play, nap, they lay in the sun, whatever. They are very relaxed in his presence. That's just a paraphrase based on the end of verse 20. This beast, if the river rages, river comes out of control, is that going to bother him? It won't bother him. Can anyone capture him when he's on watch? With barbs, can anyone pierce his nose? Anybody bring this animal into subjection? You want to tangle with him? Nobody won't tangle with him. But his nature, he's not a ferocious. I don't get the idea that he's some ferocious predator. He's big and he's strong. But that's how the Lord made him. And that just speaks to divine wisdom as God as being his creator. Okay? So there's a description of Behemoth. And that's through the end of chapter 40.
Okay, now let's look at the second one, Leviathan. This is the entire chapter 41. You can see descriptive phrase about descriptive phrase. As it begins, chapter 41, the question about Leviathan, if I can spit it out there. What's God asked Job? Are you able to do what? Can you catch him like you catch a fish? Throw a hook out there and can you reel him in? And the obvious answer is no, you can't do that. So here's another impressive creature. But look how he's described. Can you put a rope on his nose? Verse 2. Can you pierce his jaw with a hook? Verse 4. Will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him for a servant? Verse 5. Will you play with him as with a bird? Can you domesticate this creature? Will the traders bargain over him? Will they divide him among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Verse 7. Now here's something, and sometimes God does say something kind of funny, and I see some humor in this. Look at verse 8. Job, lay your hand on him. And then what's he say? You won't do it again. You may do it one time, but you won't do it a second time. You don't mess with this creature. So, like Behemoth, Leviathan also seems to be a great creature, an awesome specimen physically. But how would Leviathan differ from Behemoth based on what we've read so far in the descriptive phrases about him? Boy, aggressive is an understatement. You're right. This is a fierce being. Absolutely terrifying. We didn't get that idea about Behemoth. Not taking away his impressive attributes, but he's not described in the same way as Leviathan is. And if it be a crocodile or an alligator. Now, we've seen, what was that guy's name? The croc hunter, of course, he died recently. Remember, he got stung by that snake. But how would he go about catching one of these critters? Remember how he did it on TV? He went to all sorts of precautions because they knew you don't mess with these crocs, if that's indeed what it is. But the point seems to be, Job, give me the wisdom behind how this creature was made. All the intricate details about him that is dreaded and feared by all of the creatures and even man. Because he tells Job, you wouldn't mess with him. He's too fierce for you. He's too aggressive, as Rob said a moment ago. Other phrases there toward the end of chapter 41 talks about his teeth. Around his teeth there is terror, verse 14. Strong scales are his pride. Then starting in verse 19, I'm sorry, verse 18, this is where some get the idea that this was a dragon or some big giant serpent, because it says that he sneezes his sneezes flash forth light. Out of his mouth go burning torches. And so they get down there with some fire-breathing dragon. That's mythological. I don't think even a creature like that exists. I'm not an animal expert, but I don't think you can find such a one. I'm sorry. Yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Charles makes a good point. Job being early dated, which we've taken that position in the class, this could be taken into account some dinosaur-esque like creatures that we know nothing about, and that's entirely possible. But I think we can say with certainty Job would know who these creatures are because God referenced them to him, and he would certainly know who the Lord was talking about. So, It's some docile creature, the first one, and some ferocious, terror-driven creature, the second example. I think that's a good point to consider. There's really nothing else that's a different thing that the Lord is stressing through the end of the chapter. Verse 28, the arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones are turned into stubble for him. You can't You can't subdue him with a slingshot. That's not going to hurt him. Clubs are regarded as stubble. Verse 29, he laughs at the rattling of the javelin. Underparts are like sharp potsherds. Nothing on earth is like him. Verse 33, one made without fear. Doesn't fear anything. He looks on everything that is high. He is king over all the sons of pride. So here's this beast that Jehovah is talking about with respect to Job. And now let's look at these two together. Okay? These two beasts together and see what God is wanting Job to understand. Let's look at a summary of the speech. God has laid before Job what are some unanswerable truths. He had no answer for them. None whatsoever. Job was left speechless. At the start of the book, Job had plenty to say, didn't he? He had a lot on his mind. But he didn't have much to say now. He's been humbled greatly by this. In cataloging his creation, and when God spoke in these four chapters, using all these things that he had made as just points of reference. Job, I did this. Job, I did this. And I did this. And I did this. And can you explain how this and this and this and this works? So when God cataloged all these things, it seems that what God was doing was he wanted to show Job, convince Job of the divine wisdom that is necessary on two important fronts. Number one, to make them. Just to make them. And not just to make them, but number two then, to superintend them, to maintain control over them. Once they're made and functioning, then to control the environment in which they lived and existed. And that's what he wanted Job to see. Job, I understand all that. But you need to explain to me, since you have called me into question, then let's just see if we're on equal footing here. And that's what he wanted to get through to Job. And he got through to him. He pointed that out to Job very well. He used the inanimate world, the heavens, constellations, universe, if you will. And he wanted to ask Job to consider how all this came into being. Of course, we have evolutionists, don't we? And scientists say, I know how this came into being. Well, they do not. They don't know any more than Job knew. Any more than you and I know. But he needed to argue on that front. And he also argued on the animate world front. The individuality of each species. Go back again when you have some time. And just quickly, you don't have to read it verse by verse, but just quickly consider the different species that God made or talks about just in these four chapters. The wide variety of things that the Lord references in these chapters. And there's not many things that are alike. Person starts making something, how far do you think, how much imagination would a fellow have to have to make a vast array of different things if he were in the inventing business? I mean, you'd have to really think outside the box a lot of times to get a different, but there's not many things different that God specifies here. Particularly in these last two chapters, how different was the behemoth from the Leviathan? How different was the raven from other creatures that were mentioned? Each of these creations, of these creatures, were endowed with attributes, individual attributes, that were germane only to them. Attributes that were necessary for them to live and to function and to exist in the world that God put them in. Can we not see the wisdom behind all of that? Can we not? I've asked a question there. It's the question 11. It's the thought question on bottom page 27. And I want you to turn to Romans chapter 1. There's just one statement there that when we read over this, especially the last part of Romans chapter 1, talking about verse 18, we're quick to say, oh yes, this is God talking to the ancient Gentile world. Particularly, he's dealing with the sins of homosexuality and the degrading morality of that ancient world and how God gave them up to their vile passions. And yes, that's what the text talks about. But there's one statement I want you to focus on in verse 20. how these ancient peoples had left the glory of the incorruptible God and began to serve corruptible beasts and creatures. Verse 18, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because that which is known about God is evident within them." Talking about knowing God, knowing about Him. Now, how is it evident within them? Based on verse 19. God showed it to them. God made it evident to them. Now, how did He do that? Look at verse 20. "For since the creation of the world..." Now, look at it carefully. "For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes..." That means you can't see Him. Can you see God? You can't see God. He's invisible to the naked eye. "But His invisible attributes, His divine power and His nature, are clearly seen." Now, notice the words there. Paul says the indivisible attributes of God are clearly seen. How do we clearly see such an invisible God? How do we see Him? By the things which He made. See there? So we look at all these things. We look at the universe. We look at the flora and the fauna, all the plant life. We look at the animal life. We look at all these things. And you've heard this argument before. It's been made countless times in sermons and even at debates with Christians debating scientists or evolution advocates. You know, no, we can't say, "Show me God." Well, there He is standing right over there. We can't do that. But how in the wide world can anybody explain the existence of all that is made and how it works together just like a well-tuned clock? How can we explain that other than this great, wise, eternal being who brought it all into place with the spoken word, "Let there be this, let there be that." And it continues to function just like He wills. How do you explain that? No other explanation. Yes, please. That's the wisdom of God. That's correct. And so He wanted Job to appreciate all the different things He referenced in these two chapters. The wide variety of things. And says, "Now Job, can you explain to me how all this works? How it all fits together?" God knows how it worked. He's the one that did it. "But Job, I want you to tell me all that." And so, what He's saying is, over all this creation is this great God, this being who is mindful of every minute, intricate detail. And the point that He wants Job to see, and we're going to bring this down full circle, this really wasn't a speech or a discussion on animal life. That's not. It was just God's reference. How did this all fit Job's situation? Who is Job? Job, who are you that you should question me and how I've acted in your situation? That's really the point. Job has wanted answers. I don't like how I've been treated. I've lived my life in a way that I think you would agree with. It's been righteous. Again, how did God describe Job at the beginning of the book? He said, "There's my servant Job. There's none like him on the earth. He's a blameless man. He's an upright man. He fears evil. He walks away from all that. He serves me." But then Job began to complain. Job began to contend with God because he didn't like how he's being treated. And so God finally has His say. And He says, "Job, you've got no reason to question me in this. I know..." I don't want to make it so simple, but "Job, I know more than you do. I'm aware of things that you do not know." And so the lesson to us, this wasn't written about us, but what can we walk away from this with? What kind of practical things does this, particularly Jehovah's speeches, what should they remind us of? What practical lessons? We've got to trust Him. But we can't question Him, especially when what happens to us? Boy, we're going to have some bad times too. And we can't question Him. We're going to have to trust Him. Live for Him faithfully by what His Word teaches. And that's just all we can do about that. Okay, we'll finish up the book Wednesday night, Lord willing, and then we'll begin the new quarter next Sunday. Thank you all for your attention. If you came in late, we have new material available.